You're listening to Face Off, episode 49, recorded December 20th, 2009. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
And in this web, in this podcast, we talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view our show notes by going to faceoffshow.com. All right. So we talked about it again last week. Again, we're getting ready to go to CES. Pretty excited about that. It's really coming up fast.
Yeah, definitely.
We've never been to anything like this. So, again, if you guys have anything that you want us to check out, like a specific item that you want us to hear, you know, talk about or tweet about, even if we don't talk about it on the show, go to faceoffshow.com/feedback or hit us up on Twitter. I'm at Jade Robbins.
And I'm at Mark Sanborn.
So let us know. Before we get into our web apps, we want to talk about our geek tool of the week,
which is the P3 International Kilowatt.
Yeah. So, you know, times are tough right now. The economy is, you know, it's doing better, but things aren't, you know, what they used to be. So people are looking for ways to save money. And one of the best ways to save money is to cut down on your energy bill.
Yeah. See, I mean, I bought one of these when I first saw one because it was cheap. You know, it's $21.40 here. I plugged it in and tested all, you know, I went around the house testing different things. And, you know, it's surprising. Some of the, like, surge protectors and things that you think don't use any power are pulling, like, 40 watts all day long.
Yeah.
And they don't need to be.
So, yeah, what this is a device that you plug into your outlet, and then you plug a device into it, and it has a little LCD screen at the top that can tell you all kinds of cool little things about it. But sort of the big one is just, you know, how many watts it's using.
Yeah.
You know, because that's really what makes the little meter spin outside.
Yeah. You can even put in, you know, how much your electricity costs, 10 cents or whatever, and it calculates kilowatt hour, and it can actually do rough estimates of how much it costs.
Oh, crazy. There's all kinds of different models. They even have, like, a power strip model now, so you can, you know, take care of, you can see how much everything on your power strip is using. It's really cool. You'd be surprised what kind of devices are using a lot of power. I even read one story where a guy was doing it. He had whole house power, which are a whole different ballgame. This is just kind of one device. But he had whole house power monitoring, and some, like, all of a sudden his power bill just spiked up, and he traced it back to his refrigerator.
Wow.
Like, something went wrong, like something in his pump was wrong, and it was using, you know, three times as much power as it normally did. And it was like a little, you know, I think $20 repair job to fix it. And then his power bill went back down to a normal level.
Hmm.
I mean, and there's every device has standby, you know, consoles like Wii's and 360s and stuff that sit and just suck juice while you're not using them.
Yeah. So this is a great thing to detect some of those power suckers.
Yeah. I mean, I have an old computer that I use for a workstation and whatnot. It's got like a 500 watt power supply in it. And I found out that, you know, for what I'm doing with it, really, it should not need that much power. So I think I'm going to replace it here pretty soon with one of those little small form factor PCs that uses a lot less power so that, you know, I can cut down on my power bill.
Yeah. So if you've ever sat and been like, you know, I wonder how much power that thing's sucking. This thing's great.
Yeah. Yeah, so get a link to it so you can buy one in the show notes from Amazon. Very cool tool. Mark and I both have one, and we love it.
All right, let's get into our web apps. What do we got first?
The first web app is called Hunch, and it's this really cool web app where you can kind of ask it a question, and it'll ask you questions, and as you answer these questions, it kind of gives you its best hunch as to what you're looking for.
Hmm.
There's some really cool ones on there, like, you know, which programming language should I learn? And it'll ask you questions like, well, what kind of syntax do you like? What do you like syntax that looks like this, or looks like this, and looks like that? And you can sort of choose from that, and it'll kind of give you the best programming language you should, and a link to a book to buy it to learn it.
It also looks like they kind of have like a yes and no, so it kind of voted ranked wise too, popularity wise a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. So if you think, you know, I think that's how it gets its hunches, is by sort of deciding based on what people have answered in the past to give better hunches as time goes on.
Huh. I like how it's Python is number one. I like Python.
Well, answer well, the for questions. What I, for, yeah, yeah, I mean, answer the questions. That's I looked true. At it, and I it said that I should learn Ruby.
Yeah, if you're doing Mac stuff, it's like Objective-C.
Yeah, so like one of them is like, you know, cameras, just digital cameras. So like, you know, the first question is, how much are you willing to spend? Let's say I'm really don't have a lot of money, so I want less than 200. You know, that's sorted out basically all of the SLRs and all the big expensive ones. Do I want a point and shoot, an SLR, or a rangefinder? You know, I want just a point and shoot for parties. let's go to that, you know. And so the sort of the winning one is right now is the Panasonic Lumix, but I can keep asking questions. Like, I want to, yes, I want a camera that fits in my pocket, you know, so that kind of weeded out some of the bigger Canon ones, and you can keep going. It's great.
It's really cool.
So it's a good way to ask a question and get an answer. They don't have everything, obviously, but it'll try its best and give you its sort of hunch, which is why it's called hunch, as to what you should do.
Hmm. I mean, they have a lot of categories. It's not just technology or geeky computer kind of stuff. They've got what magazines, what TV shows should I watch, which blogs, you know.
Totally. Stuff. And it's fun just to go on there and see some of the pre-made questions already, and you can, you know, just check them out. Like a really popular one is, which programming language should I use, obviously.
Huh. If you sign in, you probably can ask a question maybe, or... Are these topics that they come
You can
up
ask
with?
A question without signing in. I think if you sign in, then you can say, like, yes, I like this. You know, I like this answer better than that one. It helps the system game it and stuff. So
cool.
Check it out, hunch.com.
All right. The next one is called Nocturnal. Why don't you tell us a little bit about this one?
Well, so, like, this weekend we had one of our friends that came out of town to visit us, our friend Travis. And naturally he wanted to go out to the various establishments around town mm-hmm. last night and have a couple of drinks and stuff. And all you, next thing you know, it's really late and we're hungry. I mean, this happens a lot. People get really hungry late. I'm terrible about it. I eat way later than I should. Mm-hmm. So what Nocturnal does is it helps you find restaurants that are open late. Some places, so like here, we're in Bozeman. The best it can do is look at what chain restaurants are in town and mm-hmm. you know, and get the hours from that. So I think what they do is they add... I think they have to individually add like a lot of the chains to find their location, to find the hours. But if you're in a bigger city too, then you can input local places and that are open late as well. So I found here in Bozeman that the place that it knows that is open 24 hours is Perkins, which we've always known. But there's a couple other local places too. So when they do add, you know, Bozeman, hopefully in the future we can add a couple of local places that we know are open really late to get some food.
So I'm assuming it's checking the current time that I've got set on my computer because it's saying like IHOP's a good one right now because they're open till 10 o'clock. You know, it knows that it's you know, only 6 o'clock and mm-hmm. you can find more stuff. Then if we were to come out here like midnight, it was maybe limit the options we have.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not sure if it checks if it uses what time it is, but I do know that like with Bozeman, it kind of says like, well, you know, I don't. All much. I know is chains. So let me look. You know, and it has Perkins website, so it knows to look there. But there you go.
This is really cool. It uses the Google Maps API, and they have these little nocturnal looking owls. You know, owls. You know. little owl pictures on the little map. It looks cool.
Yeah.
I like how they're using the Google API. And
totally. And I just like it because it's a great way to find places open late.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll have to do that and we'll have to use it in Vegas when we go to CES.
Yeah.
I don't know. Well, I don't think. Geez, I don't think we're
Vegas,
gonna.
It's all. It's open.
Everything.
24 hours.
The whole city of little owls everywhere. But you know. Pretty cool little app. Maybe we should encourage people not to eat super late, but I can't help it. I do it a lot, so. Check it out. It's at nocturne.nl.
On those domainer style names.
On the internets. All right. So last week we talked about sort of, kind of best practices episode, some of the things that we really think, you know, programmers should try and do. And I mean, I guess what I'd like to talk about, you know, what is a best practice?
Geez, I had that definition up earlier.
Well, I mean, as far as I understand it, and tell me if I'm wrong, it's sort of the, for what you're doing, the industry has sort of agreed are practices that you should follow.
Mm-hmm. Which some can, there's pros and cons of different ones, you know, but some of them are like set in stone. I know we talked about last week is documentation. That's probably, set in stone one that you should be doing.
Yeah, I mean, any professional programmer would say that documentation is important.
What was the other one we talked about? The
source control.
Source control. I mean, there's arguments on which one to use and, mm-hmm. and whether you want to do distributed versus central and different things, but it's pretty much... agreed upon that source code management is valuable tool.
These aren't like IEEE standards or anything like that. There is a standard between a standard and best practice, but I mean, you know, most programmers will agree that some sort of source code management is important and will help you be a better. It's about being better, right? Mm-hmm. Improving yourself. So last week we talked about documentation and source code management. The first thing that we want to talk about this week is unit testing.
Yeah, and I'm fairly new to unit testing. It was first introduced to me maybe a year ago or so.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since, pretty much all the programs I try to write, I use unit tests. And well, why don't you tell us a little bit, what is a unit test?
A unit test is it's like a piece of code using a testing framework that tests a unit of code.
So you're writing a program that tests your program?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, these are very helpful in both stages. It's kind of disagreement. You know, most people say you should write tests before you write your code.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard some fairly convincing arguments that that isn't always the case. But either way, some sort of test helps. Even if you write it afterwards, if you write tests for your code, it allows you to do things like refactor or implement new features. And this code will sort of automatically test to make sure you didn't break previous features that you wrote.
Okay. So it's kind of, you know, there to reduce errors and kind of speed up the refactoring.
Mm-hmm.
It also gives you kind of a specification of the program. It's like, this program should do this and should not do this.
Absolutely. You know? It sort of helps with documentation. You can look at tests of a code beforehand and see that this is sort of the things that that's supposed to do. It's also sort of a good example of a way to use that software. So a lot of ways you would do, like, let's say this code I know is supposed to take in an integer between these values and spit out, you know, a piece of a string that, you know, should be no more than like 100 characters long. So you'd write a test to say, you know, I initialize this method. If I bring in an integer between 1 and 10, it returns a string. If I give it an integer that doesn't, it breaks.
Mm-hmm. So one of the advantages, like, let's say, test-driven development, which is you write the test before you actually write the code, is, you know, a lot of times programmers are sitting there and thinking, what does it have to do? Mm-hmm. And so they get going and they say, oh, it has to do this. And they just write it and it does that.
Yeah.
Well, with test-driven development, sometimes you say, what does it have to do and what does it not have to mm-hmm. do? You have to actually say, well, it shouldn't do this. It shouldn't do this versus, well, I'm going to just build it to where it works and then I'm going to move on to some other feature.
Yeah, and with test-driven development, it also helps at the beginning because a lot of people, the sort of agreed-to methodology to this is you write the tests you need to make the program work and then you only write code to make those tests pass. You don't write anymore. It kind of helps with scope creep because, you know, a lot of times you can sort of write these tests. And if, depending upon your client, you can sort of get them to sign off on those tests. Like, okay, this is what I want the software to do. And if they add other stuff, you say, well, we don't have a test to cover it. That's another feature I'm going to have to charge you more time for.
Mm-hmm. So would you say unit testing is pretty much, you should probably have it, whether or not, you know, it still might be up in the air whether you should do it before or after you write the code, but you should probably have it. Would you say?
Yeah, I mean, there are some times where it's not really helpful. Like, a lot of programmers don't like to do it if it's just something really small, a little small True. App or something like that. The overhead of writing the test is almost not worth,
right?
Not worth it because you could just whip out the app in a couple seconds,
right?
But you know, I mean, let's say in the perfect world, yes, you should probably write tests for everything you write.
If it takes a couple hours to write it, maybe you should have the test because if you go to refactor it, it's going to save you some time there.
Yeah, and I think there is some research being done on that as to whether or not, you know, like a lot of times programmers don't want to write tests because they say, well, I don't want to have to write, you know, 4 hours of tests to write and then write, you know, 16 hours of code when I could just write 16 hours of code.
Mm-hmm.
But there is some research out there to decide, you know, to see whether or not actually writing tests, because a lot of people think, well, no, if you write 4 hours of code, that's really going to reduce the amount of code that you would write anyways. Like, let's mm-hmm. say if you didn't write the test, maybe you wouldn't have wrote 16 hours of code. You probably would have wrote 24.
Yeah.
But, it, you know, I think most programmers will agree that tests are a good thing.
Yeah, I don't remember where I saw it, but they were saying, and they had a reference to some kind of a publication where they were saying writing tests before didn't actually take any more time than not writing tests at all.
Yeah, because in the end, you ended up writing less code than you had to, or better code because you have to make the test pass.
Yeah, or you have like a clearer version of or vision of what totally. You're making.
That's a great point. Yeah, exactly. You have to sit and think about that before you write it, because a lot of times we just kind of say, if I said, hey, how long do you think it'll take you to code this? And you're like, oh, that'll take 2 hours. It never takes 2 hours. You know, mm-hmm. we always underestimate unless we have some sort of system in our head to add, you know, a couple hours to it. But this way you have to sit and think about the app you're going to write. What is the code actually going to have to do? And then you might think, oh, well, this is a more difficult problem than I thought. And I'm mm-hmm. glad that I wrote these tests because now I have a clearer idea as how long it'll take me to write the app.
Definitely.
All right, so the next sort of testing that we're going to do, or that you do after you do unit tests, would be integration tests.
And we talked about this with Eric Wendelin, one of the guests we had with Selenium. That's kind of an integration test, kind of a would you say systems test?
Like full stack test, yeah.
So integration testing is, you know, multiple units at a time, kind of testing it in the wild, or, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of how I kind of think it came from integration is to like how the chunks, different chunks will integrate together and testing the entire thing. So, I think, and I may be wrong about this, sort of one good example of sort of integration testing would be something like Cucumber in Ruby. With Cucumber, you write actual sort of user case stories, like as an administrator, in order to manage users, I want a list of users that I can select from. And then that sort of runs these specs in the background that are accessing different chunks. It's not, you know, a unit test is like, I'm going to write tests for this class.
Right.
I'm going to write tests for this method. Integration test is like, I'm going to write tests for this process.
Okay. And so integration testing is kind of just, you know, stringing a couple of unit tests together and, you know, seeing the whole picture.
Yeah, exactly. Testing like the full stack of your app. So like Eric was using Selenium, which tested sort of the application from the UI standpoint of the browser. So that's definitely integration testing, because that background code sort of has to work to put out what the browser expects to see. You know, if I remember correctly, kind of what he said is you can look for this div, you can look for this field, you can look for this, and that, you know, if your code, underlying code, is working, you should see that. So that's a form of integration testing.
Okay. The next one is one step build process. You know, if you've got to go through this rigmarole to build out, you know,
yeah,
your program, it's,
yeah, you don't see it as much with web program. We don't tend to do builds.
True.
But like a lot of time, if you're using Java code, things like that, you need to be testing your builds as you're designing it. And I mean, there's kind of ways to apply this to a web app that doesn't exactly have a build, but if you have some sort of way to do, you know, one bill, you know, like I can pull the code down from the repository and have it run and work in 1 second. That's kind of a one-step build.
Well, how about as an example, it's kind of more of a release than a build, but how about what's that Ruby program that puts it up for you? Like, use it too.
Capistrano.
Capistrano, yeah. Yeah. We're going to automatically get things ready, throw it up on the thing.
That's totally a great example.
Restart like if you have, server. It does it all in one step.
Like, if you have like a dev server, let's say you could put in like a Git hook that every time someone pushes something to the repository, it runs this Capistrano script that you know, puts it up on the server, runs all the necessary rake tasks and stuff you need, and then restarts the server and fires it up for you. That's a great example of sort of a one build process. It's fully automated. When people commit it, it's up on the dev server. You know, no thinking about it required.
Part of these daily builds is to help, you know, if somebody puts out some code, at least you're going to know right away if you broke the system.
Yeah.
And, you know, the whole system.
Hopefully. I mean, hopefully they should have caught that beforehand. But the problem is, kind of, we talked about this last time, we were talking about source control or source code management, is that you want to make sure that it works all the time. So if you can perform sort of this daily or instant build process every time, then you don't have to keep going back like, oh man, when did this break? Let's go back 30 steps. Okay, it's broken. Go yesterday. Back 40 steps. Okay, then, you know, but if it's building all the time, then you're going to that server, looking at that build, and when something doesn't work, you know right away. You don't have to sort of play the when did this break in the past.
And I noticed a lot of open source projects, even like Chromium and things, have daily builds, and that's basically what this is.
Yeah, yeah. It works great for an open source app like that, because they have a lot of people that, even if they aren't part of the project working on it, want the newest stuff all the time and are willing to sort of be that tester. So when, you know, every night it does a build of all the work you've done during the day, people can go download it, get the nightlies, and install it and play with it and see, you know, they'll let you know right away if something broke.
Right. The next big one is bug tracking database.
Yeah.
Issue tracking, bug tracking.
Totally. And, I mean, look at our source code management blowout. A lot of these smaller, or a lot of the source code management things, have this integrated. Like even GitHub has really simple issue tracking built in. You can get into really complex systems. You and I both use a Ruby project called Redmine that we use for our bug tracking. I love it. We use it at work, and I use it personally just because I think it's a really good program. And I'm really familiar with it. But there's lots of other ones out there, Lighthouse, Basecamp. But you need to keep track of those. You can't just keep doing it on a pen and paper or in a notepad, you know, a text file on your computer.
Yeah, sometimes, I mean, you'll be like, oh, I know all the bugs, you know. And then all of a sudden, the next day, you're like, somebody calls you up on the phone. It's like, oh, I need this, and you kind of forget about them and things. You need a place to put them. And you need a place to come back and respond to them. And so other people, especially if you're working with other people, you know, other programmers, so they can come in and see the bugs and work on them. Yeah. So it's not, you know.
So even if you know, a lot of projects have it so anonymous, people can't submit bugs, so they can get as many bugs as possible. Mm-hmm. But even not, then, I mean, even if you have your programmers inputting bugs, you never know. This helps them, you know, if you have an issue tracker, I can go in and take an issue. Then you know that I'm working on that. You don't have to do all the work on it just because you submitted it. Why should you have to do the work on it? Mm-hmm. It lets everybody else know what kind of bugs are going on, both publicly and internally, you know, depending upon what you have set up. It, you know, lets people know what's happening.
Definitely. So we use Redmine. There's probably one for every language.
Absolutely.
That you know, pick your favorite and
totally. There are two types of them though, and you have to be careful. So like Redmine is definitely sort of a software project management app. Mm-hmm. There's some out there that are like more support issue applications, like geez, I can't remember any of them right now, but they're really made for like support personnel, not really programmers. So look at them, try them out, and see if you guys have some that you use and like. Let us know. I'm really curious to hear what everyone else uses, because I just got lucky. We used someone at work knew about Redmine, and I ended up really liking it. But I'm curious what else is out there. I've tried Basecamp, wasn't my thing.
Redmine was really easy to install too.
Yeah,
I know Track is a big one. Bugzilla.
Yeah, I don't like the kind of big ones like that. We tried Google Code. For a project we were working on, and that really didn't mesh with me well either. Mm-hmm. So what else are you guys using out there? Let us know. Go to faceoffshow.com/feedback.
GitHub has issues and things too, doesn't it?
GitHub and Mercurial, or I mean Bitbucket.
Yeah. Check out our source code management blowout episode.
Yeah, a lot of those have really basic issue tracking. I like sort of the granularity that Redmine allows me, even though I don't have really very big projects I'm working on, but it's nice.
Speaking of bugs, it's probably best idea to fix bugs before you write new features.
Yeah, I think that's sort of an accepted practice as well, because your features may create more bugs, and then after a while, all you know is you have a ton of bugs. And
it's also good to know that you have a clean slate. Like if you know you've got all your bugs fixed, and someone's like, "Well, let's implement this new cool feature," you can do that day. You can start working on it.
Yeah.
You don't have to worry about the previous bugs before you start on something new.
Or a new feature, you know, you might find out, you know, plan it though. Like a new feature might erase a bug that was there, you know. But often that isn't the case. Usually there are bugs that you have to fix and take care of them first.
Yep. Don't live with broken windows. So the next one is have a schedule. And this is something I have to admit I haven't done as much. I know you kind of got into that where you say, like, this release, we're going to do these features. And
yeah, like Redmine has a really sort of good version tracking thing where you can create a new version of your software, set a release date for it. Each ticket you can have sort of a due date on it and things like that. Again, this is one of those things most people won't want to use. The overhead seems like a lot. And I tend to agree. I'm one of those people that have a hard time with that. Mm-hmm. But it never hurts to set goals for yourself. Usually, most people will tell you, you'll never know you're there until you decide what there is and mm-hmm. when you're going to get there.
True.
You have to know what target you're trying to hit before you start throwing darts.
I think having a schedule also limits some of the scope creep and some of that too, because it's like, here, we need to be done on this date, and you know, have especially if you're a single programmer, you're gonna have pretty flexible dates because you're the only guy. But
totally, depending upon what sort of project management style you use, even the traditional ones and the agile ones both have dates. You set specific dates, and then it just kind of depends on how you treat that date. So like with, you know, Agile, you say that you have a sprint and the sprint is done at this date, and you work up that functional bit of code that you promised for that next sprint. And even if you get it done before the date, you then refactor up until that date comes. Mm-hmm. Traditional project management is that you get it done sort of on that date, and then, you know what you're going to do the next chunk, and it's all laid out ahead of time.
Yeah, that makes a big difference when you can just log in and say, or see, you know, oh, this feature needs to be done, and you have a schedule laid out.
Totally.
It makes you a lot more productive, I think.
Yeah, and like with Redmine, with our project that we're working on at work, we set up, mini versions like 0.0, 0.1, 0.2. We set due dates for them, and it's a good metric to say, did we get the things done that we were going to in this sprint, you know, mm-hmm. yes or no? And sometimes if your sprints are late, then, you know, you feel guilty because you log in and it's like, hey, this sprint is, you know, this, you had 20 tickets for this version, you know, you're 80% done and this thing is 10 days late. You know, you like, oh, I have to get that done.
The next one is program specification, and I have a little note here. It's kind of funny. Writing specs is like flossing. Everybody agrees that it's a good thing, but nobody does it.
It's true.
I read in Code Complete, I actually got that book that we were talking about. They said program specification is one of the most critical things you can do for software development, like planning-wise.
Really?
So an example of a program specification is like this. When the user clicks the OK button, the dialog is closed, and then the focus is returned to the main window in the state it was before the dialog was displayed. So it's kind of like, as from the user's perspective, what does it do?
Mm-hmm.
The details can be worked out later, but yeah. This is what it needs to do.
Totally.
And so these are kind of like user stories. The agile kind of realm of things.
That kind of like the cucumber stuff is called behavior-driven development, which is you sort of write these tests based off user behavior, but these behaviors are a lot like user specs like this.
Yeah, and so if you have this program spec laid out and you say, oh, the user needs to click OK and needs to do this, you have a clear idea what you needed to get done.
Yeah.
You don't have you as a programmer still have to figure out how you're going to make this happen, but it's all laid out, it's ready to go.
Yeah.
You see that and you can go to work.
Totally. I can see why people don't want to write these.
Yeah, that's true.
They're very time consuming.
Definitely. But like the schedule, I think this is going to limit the scope creep and things. This is like this is what the user needs and make it.
Totally. It's a lot of these things too, though, like, you know, writing tests, both unit tests and integration tests and specs, they're very important, but you also have to be careful. They are very much a rabbit hole. So I look at this spec that you use as an example, and I think it's a little too detailed for my taste.
Okay.
Because the problem with these sometimes is you can just get so deep, like especially with tests, right? You can write tests till you pass out because you haven't eaten anything for 2 weeks, because you can always write tests for a different use case. And you have to try and find that balance of, am I getting too detailed and is it useful? You know, because a lot of times, you know, it's almost like this sort of, you know, this curve where, you know, no tests are totally useless and way too many tests is just almost a waste of time. You probably should have stopped writing tests a while ago and written some code, but you want these sort of middle, you know, of the road, good functional tests that actually help you out.
Definitely. The next one is hallway testing. So I guess they did this study where they found that if you asked, you know, just 6 random people to use something, you know, I mean, if it's a really technical program, maybe that wouldn't work out. But most programs, you can find 95% of the usability problems.
That's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about a similar study when we were talking about web design and finding usability problems.
Yep.
It's the same kind of thing with programming. Just find some random people and have them try out your program.
It's so hard to be invested in a project and find everything that's wrong with it because it all makes sense to you. You've been in this team, you've been at meetings, you're discussing what it's going to do, what's going to happen, and to you it sounds great. You've had you as a team have hashed it out. You feel like you've come up with the best solution in the world, and when you go to use it, it works and is great. It works just like you expect it, but that's not the use case that you're writing this for. There, you know, you and I did this when we were working on I can't remember what site design it was. We had my wife test it and we found some things. She was just like, well, I don't really know where I'm supposed to go. And you're like,
really?
I thought it was really clear.
Yeah, definitely. And the study was, by the way, is Jacob Nielsen's research. So, and we'll put a link in the show notes to that.
But it's crazy that it only takes six people and you can find that so many problems with it.
Yep.
So, I mean, but it's really important to get people that haven't been looking at this. I mean, it happens to me with spelling. I'll write an article or something for one of my blogs and I'll proofread it.
Mm-hmm.
And I proofread it and I found maybe 2 mistakes, but it looks good. And then you hand it to someone that isn't you. I mean, in your head, everything, for me anyways, in my head, everything I write sounds great. First time, it's exactly the way I wanted it to be. It sounds perfect. And then when someone else reads it, they say, I have no clue what you're talking about there. And you're like, okay, because to me it sounded perfect. And the same thing, I mean, a second pair of eyes on code can help you a ton because the code always looks right to you because you've been staring at it. So it's kind of the same principle, but with the whole project as itself. You've been working on this project, staring at it for so long. It all looks great to you. If there's something wrong with it, you would have fixed it by now. But does it work for other people?
Definitely. Just, you know, reach out the hallway, grab somebody, have them come in and test it.
Now, I was not making that connection.
Okay. Well, yeah, just any random, brother, sister, mom, uncle, dog, pet, whatever. Get them in there, try it out.
I know. I'm tired of wiping dog slobber off my mouth. Sandborn, you should quit testing with my computers. So those are some of the things that we came up with as some of the best practices out there for web programmers. Again, guidelines. I mean, the best practices is an ambiguous term, but those are some of the things that we think are really important.
Mm-hmm. And if we miss something, major, definitely send us some feedback. Call us on our line or go to faceoffshow.com/feedback.
Yeah,
leave a comment, whatever, and
tweet us out with your fist shaking, saying, "What are you guys thinking?" Because I know, I mean, we've talked about this, but I've had a couple of buddies of mine that have listened to the show that don't agree with some of our philosophies on testing. I know I have a friend, Rob Lund, one of the guys we're going to CES with, who worked for a company that did everything test-driven, very hardcore test-driven development, and he didn't like it. He felt that he could see some of the benefits of it, but he felt that the time spent was not worth the benefit. So, again, they're very flexible things, and find out what works for you. I really like test-driven development. I think it's great, and I really want to use it more out as I go out there, but it's not for everyone. So let us know what you think, I guess, was the sort of end result of that big, long blurb of talking. So that wraps it up. Listen, we want you guys to know, if you haven't subscribed yet, go to faceoffshow.com/subscribe. You can subscribe via email, RSS, all kinds of ways. Let us know if you have anything you want us to talk about or any corrections, anything, by going to faceoffshow.com/feedback. Tweet us out, email us, send us a voicemail, anything. Thanks, guys. We will see you next week.